hello, and welcome to the Promise Institute podcast. My name's Jess Peak, and I'm the Assistant Director of the Promise Institute for Human Rights at UCLA School of Law. In this episode of the podcast, I will be chatting with Pwint Chun, who is a non-residential fellow in the Myanmar program at the Harvard Ash Center for Democratic Governance and Innovation. Pwint has been instrumental in shaping policies of Myanmar's telecommunications reform and mobile financial service industry, and worked to influence policy changes, working closely with the President's Office, the Central Bank of Myanmar, and the Ministry of Communications and Information Technology. Pwint is in the midst of mobilizing a nationwide digital literacy campaign targeted for marginalized populations in Myanmar. She's held various senior management roles at US-based telecommunications and IT companies and has a BS in electrical engineering from the University of Washington and a master's in engineering management from Northwestern University. Today, Pwint and I will be discussing the situation on the ground in Myanmar following the February 1st military coup in the country. So welcome, Pwint. It's really nice to have you on the podcast. To kick things off, could you start by giving us a little bit of background on the circumstances that led to the coup back in February?
Thank you so much for having me on this podcast. And so as some of you may have been hearing about what's happening in Myanmar, the country had an election in November of 2020, shortly after US had an election in November. And the Burmese Democratic Forces, National League for Democracy, won the landslide for the election. The military party lost shamefully. And the military was not willing to go quietly into the night. So the military announced on February 1st that they conducted the military coup and arrested all these democratically elected members of parliament, many of the government officials, ministers, central bankers have all been thrown in jail. But for the many people inside the country, this is a history repeating itself. We have lived under the military dictatorship for many years. Since 1962, there has been repeated coup and the dictators coming in. And the dictators in Myanmar have been using the military as their own commander-in-chief's personal army. And the court system inside Myanmar have been used to protect the military from any accountability. So with that, the military just took advantage of that and conducted the coup. So in many ways, February 1st coup of Myanmar is the military's attempt to repeat after exactly what happened actually in US on January 6th as well. Except in Myanmar, with a country that's struggling to come out of the long years under the military dictatorship, the outcome became very different than the US.
I'm putting to one side, and we'll definitely come back to the parallels with the United States. But before we get to that, practically speaking, on February 1st, what happened? You said a number of people were detained, and there's been many reports of really egregious human rights violations against people within Myanmar. But could you describe a little bit sort of what happened on that date and what has been happening since then?
On the February 1st early morning, the military started arresting people actually before even the dawn breaks. The president of the country, the state councilor of the country, and many of the MPs, they were all detained. The newspaper reporters, many of them have been detained. Since then, more than 800 unarmed civilians have been killed at the hand of the military. It has become a completely lawless society at the moment, and thousands of civilians have been arrested and put into jail. And this is actually in the midst of the pandemic that they've decided to conduct this coup, that the challenges that is faced by an everyday citizen inside the country is very much horrifying. And what the military did is also they shut off the internet on the first day. And after that, they shut off the internet across the entire country for several months. That was an attempt to control the information. That was an attempt to really control the population of the country into submission.
So there's a lot to unpack in there. Maybe let's start with the rationale for the arrests and detentions. We know that Aung San Suu Kyi was arrested and has been detained. We know other senior leaders have been detained, and that many, many civilians too. On what basis are these people being thrown into jail?
So the military loves to use the phrase in accordance with the law or in accordance with democracy as a way of trying to rationalize their coup. For the president and for state counselor Aung San Suu Kyi, the excuses that they were given, initial excuse to arrest them, was that Aung San Suu Kyi had imported a walkie-talkie illegally. And for the president, the claim was that he had broken a law by hosting a series of cars to drive in front of a party rallying, where he's standing at the street corner and waving at the parade of cars driving by. And that was what the military claimed as breaking the COVID regulation and arresting them. So these artificial laws that the military is just coming up with. And there's one new law that they have come up with called Article 505, which means you disagree with what the military is saying. And it's become this catch-all for everyone inside the country. With this military amendment of the Code of the Criminal Procedure, by adding this new section of 505A, which allows the military to arrest anyone expressing dissent about the coup, anyone expressing dissent about the military, or even just to criticize online or in public protest, it's a criminal offense subject to imprisonment. So hundreds of activists, including celebrities, movie stars, have been all arrested without warrant under 505A since the adoption on February 16th of this year.
That's really horrific to hear that, you know, so many artificial bases are being used for the detention of various groups of people across Myanmar by the military. Could you tell us a little bit about what the civilian response has looked like? You mentioned that this law, Article 505, is aimed at sort of suppressing dissent. What does that expression of dissent look like in the country?
The expression of dissent has been very fierce. The civilians, millions of people across the country, have resorted to nonviolent civil disobedience movement. Civil servants have stopped going to work. Doctors and nurses are refusing to work for the military. Bank employees are refusing to work. People are just refusing, like completely stopping this bureaucratic mechanism of the ability to govern. And also protests are happening. People are inspired by the Hunger Games, which really about the rebellion against the authoritarian regime, by showing this three-finger salute all across the country, and young people to older ladies shuffling on the street are all saying, this is enough is enough. But also, what has really been the feeling of insecurity for everyone inside the country is that since February 1st, soldiers and police can march into any household, to search and seize anything or anyone at will without a warrant. So this also allows for arbitrary detentions to happen every day. And anyone can be held by the military or police for any length of time without any reason or any charges. And personally, I mean, I've been hearing stories about many people are reporting security forces searching houses and businesses are stealing cash and valuables, including things like rice and smartphones. While they're searching the houses, while they're holding the residents, including children, at gunpoint. And this kind of lawlessness being conducted by the soldiers and police is rampant across the country. So the population is also saying, if we put up with this military coup, the future generations are going to be living under the same fear of this military and soldiers. So people are refusing to bow down. It's been 4 months since the coup, and people may not have food to eat and are suffering, but refusing to bow down to the military.
And how has people been organizing themselves? You mentioned internet shutdowns, and I know that that has been a giant problem in the country. So how are people finding each other and coming together in these protest movements?
The smartphone that is pervasive in everyone's hand has been a tool. But when the internet was shut down, people resorted to phone trees to be being able to communicate. So even when the entire country's mobile networks were shut down, few people who had access to internet through the fiber, actual physical fiber to the home, were able to still get access. And that's a very, very small percentage of the population that had access. They gather the news and they share them with other people through the phone tree and share and mobilize through with whatever ability that they had to continue moving forward. So the voice call was what people resorted to. But that also means that, you know, the military started implementing the new restrictions in February to the existing telecommunications law to legalize the military interception of all communications, including text messages and social media. So which actually means that people, even though they're using the phone to communicate with each other, there is also a possibility that the military could very well be listening in on the conversation so that they can come and arrest you. So the sense of fear is very much pervasive. Of anyone can walk through your door anytime to search your house and with guns in their hand is pretty much that constant fear that the whole country is living under for the last 4 months.
That sounds terrifying for the people who are having to live through that. You mentioned, Quint, that the protests have largely been peaceful by the civilians and civil society who have managed to organize themselves to resist the measures that are being imposed following this military coup. But we know from human rights reporting and the media that the military response has been anything but peaceful. Could you maybe tell us a little bit about what that has looked like on the ground?
Actually, Myanmar has the world's longest ongoing civil war. The country of Myanmar or Burma did not exist before Britain invaded several the areas and created pretty much the country called the area called Burma. But many of these mountainous regions surrounding the lowland Burman area, the population have never really given in to the lowland based Buddhist Burman led Burmese military in the first place. So there has been armed resistance against the military for many decades. And those ethnic armed organization areas have become the safe refuge for many people who are being oppressed and shot at by the military in the urban areas. When the military started gunning down unarmed protesters and started arresting people and started confiscating offices and reporters, people started running towards the areas where the ethnic armed organizations in the border areas. So people have fled towards India border, China border, Thailand border. So even though the world heard about what happened for the Rohingya population in 2017, when the Rohingya population fled to the Bangladesh border, that same type of oppression has been happening inside the country of Myanmar against other ethnic groups for many years. So what is happening today is that people in the urban area are finally getting experienced what has been happening for many other ethnic populations for decades before. So the Rohingya population, horrifying, having to flee the country towards Bangladesh, it's being repeated by many, many, many people across the country. There are so many people who are displaced, even in the urban area, in the ethnic areas. I don't even know if there's like people have a good grasp of how many people are displaced inside Myanmar at the moment. From my understanding, there's more than 150,000 people have been displaced, newly displaced since the military coup, where people are hiding in the jungle, drinking unclean water, running away from these horrifying attacks by the military.
I definitely don't think that people understand the extent of the internal displacement that has happened since February. I mean, obviously, I think that the situation of the Rohingya and what happened in 2017 has been very well documented and given a lot of attention in the international community, and rightly so. But I certainly think that the fact that this is happening to so many other ethnic groups within Myanmar, and that so many people are being forced to flee their homes, is not getting anywhere near the same level of coverage and attention that the Rohingya did. And so I think it's really important to highlight just exactly what is happening and what the experiences of those different groups are. You mentioned a few times, Quint, that the military seems to act in a way that is lawless. What do you mean by that exactly?
So the military in Myanmar had decided to pass the constitution that they had drafted back in 2008, which was already considered an illegitimate tool of the military control. And in that military passed constitution, the armed forces enjoyed impunity, complete impunity. So Article 445 of the constitution grants blanket impunity to all members of the military, protecting them from legal accountability. The current constitution that the military has been holding is the roots of the lawlessness inside Myanmar. So with that, the soldiers and the police, the security forces, can act whether they're breaking into people's houses or they're killing children. There is no legal accountability inside the country of Myanmar. And partly also because there has been the court system and the justice system has been a tool of the military since 1962. So international community is going to have to play a key role in seeking accountability for the past and the current ongoing gross violations of human rights in Myanmar. And I know there are, you know, proceedings underway at the International Court of Justice, and there are investigations seeking to hold Myanmar accountable for the violations against the ethnic minorities. But we need to make sure to hold them accountable, not just for what the military has done against the Rohingya Muslims relating to the illegitimate forced displacement to Bangladesh, but also towards how the military has violated the human rights of civilians across the country. The international accountability has to capture the full gamut of all these crimes, and not just at the highest level of the military, but perpetrators from the officer corps to the foot soldiers that are actually pulling the trigger, they need to be held accountable as well. Because I think with the international accountability process, the state of Myanmar needs to be built from ground up to create an impartial legal system in the country, which does not exist at the moment.
What would that look like?
a state building process within Myanmar? Like, what are the elements that would need to be stripped away and restructured to make a functioning society that has law that is applicable to all individuals?
The constitution is where it has to start. At the moment, there is actually nothing that's really defining what it means to belong to the country of Myanmar. And Myanmar has had such a dubious relationship with the idea of the law for the last 50 years. So we're going to have to build ground up. We have to replace that 2008 constitution that the military passed when thousands of people were dying from the cyclone and were not able to vote. That was when the military passed this constitution. So that constitution has been abolished, actually, by the military coup on February 1st of 2021. So technically, there is actually no constitution in Myanmar at the moment. So we have to build everything from the ground up in the state building exercise that is wholly inclusive, and also make sure that every citizen in all the people of Myanmar have equal rights, guaranteed citizenship for every single, all ethnic and religious communities. And that constitution needs to declare an end to military impunity and protect civic space and rebuild the entire legal systems to serve as a check and balance for those in power. It's going to be extremely important. Without the functioning domestic legal system, without functioning impartial court system, there has been no trust in the judiciary up till now as a result. So we will have to leave the military impunities firmly in the past. So Myanmar is going to need to design a constitution that protect the civilians. And that constitution would need to establish a federal democracy with equal rights for all people of Myanmar. And we need to guarantee citizenship for all ethnic and religious communities and declare an end to the military's impunity. Only when we have a functioning domestic legal system with the impartial court system, then can we also begin to imagine a more peaceful future where people have more faith and trust in the judiciary. And the entire society need to leave the military's impunity firmly behind in the past.
Thank you, Quint. How do we create the situation to allow that to happen? Revisiting the constitution and sort of creating a new society basically from scratch is sort of what you're proposing. So what are the circumstances that need to change to create an environment to allow that to happen?
Well, first of all, we need to make sure that the whole world and all the states does not recognize this military coup. They are illegitimate. These coup makers are illegitimate. And it is extremely important that ASEAN and China really holds the military accountable and tell them that they are illegitimate coup makers, that they are not legitimate government. They are not leaders of the country, that they are committing treason by conducting this coup on February 1st of 2021. And only then, and with the support of neighboring countries. And we have elected government members that managed to escape the imprisonment, that have formed a parallel government called National Unity Government, which is very much a legal government that has been elected and that has the support of the population. So the international communities need to start recognizing the real elected officials. And then we need to start building the legal education with access to high quality legal education. And we need to produce the well-trained lawyers and advocates as well, so that we can start building these key foundations. What is really hopeful for me is that the country of Myanmar, there are so many smartphones and access to telecommunications connectivity once the internet gets turned back on, that ability for information to disperse and train the new population using Zoom and all kinds of information communication technology is very much there.
So I know that that is your area of research, right, is telecommunications and thinking about how that can be restructured and harnessed to make change. Could you say a little bit more about that potential that exists in Myanmar?
Myanmar may be one of the poorest countries in the ASEAN, but internet connectivity in Myanmar, over the last decade, there has been a lot of reform in the telecommunications infrastructure area. And with affordable connectivity being offered by competitive telecommunications providers, 95% of the population have access to fast mobile coverage. And as a result of the people coming online so late in the game, people started adopting smartphones as the connectivity tool. And that's the first communication device that they buy is most likely a used smartphone for even the people in the rural area. So that actually telecommunication infrastructure holds huge potential to be able to reach millions of people all at the same time. And to be honest, I think that is the reason why the military have been very much threatened by telecommunication infrastructure and shut down the network, because they have not been able to control information in Myanmar. When the reason the whole world knows about what happened with the Rohingya population was because smartphones were there. People were able to report what was happening on the ground as things were happening. And the reason why many people outside the country did not know about how the military committed atrocities against other ethnic areas before was because people did not have smartphones in their hand to capture what's really happening and report from the ground. So right now, people who are fleeing and hiding in the jungle or whatever is happening is being captured by the smartphones and have the population have access to a huge amount of information and knowledge sharing. And I think this is going to be helpful in the long run as we rebuild the country, as we rebuild the human resource capacity. Even this past several weeks, the National Unity Government, the parallel government, has started offering training to more than 1,000 medical school students on Zoom, teaching them by the specialists that are based in UK. So the medical doctors are training the medical students through Zoom. This online connectivity has massive potential to rebuild the human resource capacity of the population. So I think if we were able to train the next generation of doctors through Zoom in the midst of pandemic, in the midst of this coup, I really don't see why information and telecommunications infrastructure can't be used to train the next generations of legal minds, young legal minds in Myanmar.
Absolutely. And 95% connectivity is an astonishing number in any country. So that is really something that has the potential to affect a huge amount of change. On the flip side of that connectivity, though, is the internet being used for propaganda purposes. And I know that the military have been using the internet in such a way, particularly since February 1st, but there's a long history of propaganda usage there. So could you explain a little bit about what that has looked like and some of the dangers that flow from these connectivity issues?
Absolutely. The military has formed dedicated teams of people to write misinformation content, and they have been using strategic misinformation, warfare, psychological warfare as a tool for their purposes, that it's very much like North Korea in a way, where if you read the state newspapers, you will get a completely different reality than what's really happening on the ground. And in the earlier days of in 2016, 2017, as people were coming online with extremely low digital literacy, coming out from not having ability to distinguish whether it's a real image or is it a doctored image with a Photoshopped image, many people in Myanmar really struggled with that in the past, because when the military is using misinformation as a very important tool to shape the narrative that the military is telling the whole people, everyone in the country, that without them, the entire country is going to fall apart. Without them, the race and the religion of Myanmar is going to disappear. And that type of misinformation has continued to be quite pervasive on social media as well. So But at this point, the number of people using social media that is able to counter and are able to see the psychological warfare, the digital, along with the digital savviness, the population, the psychological warfare points seems to be able to be countered by people, civilians more.
That's really great.
But I think what I would like to add one thing. It's like, for me, as somebody who's been working in poverty alleviation and women empowerment, it's been really heartbreaking, because we have made all these massive progress over the past decade, and all these progress are erased by the military in the last 4 months. And with this military having a cash crunch crisis, people that are going to be impacted economically are the poorest, the most marginalized, farmers. And with these challenging situations, the marginalized population of Myanmar is in extremely vulnerable situation. And I can really warn that the international community need to be bracing for a major humanitarian catastrophe in Myanmar. Because amidst the pandemic, the junta forced open schools on June 1st. And nearly a million children are back in school right now with extremely low vaccination rate. Contagion is being forced upon the population, and COVID pandemic in Myanmar is going to be just like in India in the not too distant future. With porous borders between India and Burma, the pandemic is already raging in the border states that borders India. And so the international community really need to be bracing for this humanitarian catastrophe, because significant percentage of the population will be depending upon the World Food Program to feed themselves in the coming months. And it's also extremely dangerous, because the neighboring countries like Thailand and Malaysia will need to be taking in many of these, they will have to be dealing with the fallout out of this, because it's very possible that, you know, another strain of COVID could come out of this as well, with low vaccination rate, pervasive children being forced into school, and people are vulnerable, and health infrastructure system is already broken, with doctors and nurses being jailed by the military. It's a broken system. It's a man-made humanitarian disaster in the making that we're looking at.
That is very terrifying to contemplate, and also an extremely real consideration, because, yeah, of course, we have to remember that all of this, all of these human rights violations, all of this displacement is taking place in the context of an ongoing global pandemic in a country that wasn't, to my knowledge, very well equipped to begin with in dealing with that. And this situation has only exacerbated the circumstances of people on the ground exponentially. And so I think everything you're saying is completely justified, and really something that neighboring countries, but also the entire international community need to have in mind, because this is going to be something that we will need to deal with in the very near future. So thank you very much, Quint, for all of this. Before we wrap up, maybe I could just return to something you said right at the beginning, which was this interesting point between the parallels with the coup in Myanmar and what happened in the United States with our November election, and also the events in Washington, D.C. on January 6th. It unfortunately seems like the coup in Myanmar has been grabbed onto by QAnon and some other far-right online forums in the U.S. as something to be celebrated. And this past weekend, Michael Flynn, who was President Trump's first national security advisor, appeared to endorse a similar military-style coup in the United States. Although, of course, I should note that in the past couple of days, he's walked that back despite videos to the contrary, which seem to very clearly have him saying exactly that. So could you just help us think about the parallels between these two situations, and also why a military coup like this is something that people on the far right, supporters of President Trump, might be attracted to in this particular situation?
I feel like what happened in Myanmar is a warning to the democratic forces around the world. January 6th absolutely was that key tipping point. If it was not for the Constitution of the U.S., and if the military can be used by commander-in-chief as a personal military army, the dangers of that as well. And what happened inside the country has very much implications, because when Michael Flynn said what he said last week, the Burmese military took those and been sharing it very widely by the Burmese military's propaganda, saying, see, Michael Flynn agreed with that U.S. should have done the same thing that the government of Myanmar, the military of Myanmar, had done by overthrowing a democratically elected government. So that treasonous statement of saying that the same type of things should happen in the United States is extremely dangerous, slippery slope that is really, and also empowering and emboldening the Burmese military. And when you can see on the Burmese military's misinformation websites that sharing the actual video of Michael Flynn's talking points and saying United States agreed that the same type of thing should be done for the United States for this type of coup, it is extremely dangerous to the concept of democracy for many countries around the world. So I think Myanmar is a warning, lessons learned on what not to do in the democratic transitions.
Thank you, Quint. We definitely need to take heed of that warning about the dangers of democracy that this type of activity poses and continues to pose. And I'm sure our audience, and I know I, will be paying attention to what goes on in Myanmar from this point forward to see what is able to be salvaged from this military coup, and really with the hope that we can see some kind of return to normality in the very near future, where people are able to return to their homes and no longer live in fear. But I also am very mindful that it isn't going to be that easy, and that Myanmar is going to need a lot of support in effectuating many of the reforms that you've proposed around law reform and constitutional reform, and also the provision of humanitarian assistance. So thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today. It was wonderful to have you on the Promise Institute podcast. And I wish you the best of luck with all of your research and the projects that you're currently undertaking at the Ash Center at Harvard.
Thank you very much for the invitation, Jess. It's an honor to be here.
Conversations like these are made possible because of supporters. That can mean following us on social media and helping spread the word on the work we're doing. It can mean donating to help us grow our programming and efforts, or both. We're at Promise Inst UCLA on social. That's Promise, I-N-S-T, UCLA. And to make a donation, please visit law.ucla.edu bit.ly/supportpromise. Lastly, please be sure you're subscribed to the show so you can be notified of new episodes, and leave a review if you feel so inclined. Thank you so much, and till next time, take care.